This is Seattle's Morning News. Typically, when we talk about sending someone to prison, we focus on how much time they're going to serve and pay very little attention to what condition they will be in when they are released, as 95% of inmates are. And Dr. Christine Montross writes about this in a book called Waiting for an Echo. You have chosen to work with the kinds of prisoners that no one wants to touch, the psychiatric patients. And that's my first question. Why did you choose this career?
I work in the intensive treatment units, which are the psychiatric version of the ICU. And as you indicate, I learned over the years that my patients often came in contact with police, and frequently not because of any kind of criminal intent, but because they were hearing voices or seeing visions, paranoid, or really trying to hurt themselves. And in those moments, police were called and they got swept up in the legal system, when often they needed a therapeutic environment rather than a punitive one.
Right. And you point out that in prison, the way it works is you follow the rules and we enforce the rules by punishing you. But if you have no capability of forming intent and can't follow rules, all that does is make it worse. And yet you're up against, I think it's fair to say, taxpayers who are so, fed up with these stories about either acts committed by mentally ill people or other crime in general, that they're just ready to throw away the key. They really don't care what goes on in the prison.
Right. I think that we have to help people understand, as you say, that 95% of people leave our prisons and come back to our communities. So it doesn't serve us well to dehumanize and degrade them when they're in prison. It instead serves us better to help them become less apt to commit crimes, less apt to return to prison once they leave. And that's a reality that would serve us all well, in addition to being one that's more humane. I think that the taxpayer argument, for the long run, it's certainly very expensive to keep people incarcerated and to keep people who come back to jail over and over again incarcerated. So really investing in people in the front end to keep them out in the communities, working in jobs, facilitating their own relationships, and paying taxes and being better neighbors, that helps everyone.
Yeah. We could talk forever about how bad prison conditions are, but I'm curious if there's anyone anywhere in the world who's doing it right, so that rather than reinventing everything ourselves, we could follow a model that not only helps the inmates, but is also accepted by the wider community as providing the just punishment that people insist on when someone's arrested.
You know, we say we want safety and justice. We say we want lower recidivism, but our current practices don't do that. And my research led me to Sweden and Norway, where they had problems very much like ours in the 1990s. Their prison system was fraught with violence. There were murders of correctional officers and other detainees. Their recidivism rate was between 60 and 70%, which is right where ours is now. Ours is at 68%. Oh. And they realized their current practices weren't working. They took a really revamped approach, and how they describe it is they say they stopped meeting hard with hard, and they started meeting hard with soft. What they meant by that was that they do a needs assessment when the person comes in to see what are the factors that led to you becoming involved in criminal behavior, that led you to prison, and let's use the time of the sentence constructively to address those deficiencies so that when you leave here, you don't come back. So if you need mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, education, job skills training, anger management, rather than the very American idea of just doing time, let's use the sentence constructively to address those needs that you have so that when you leave here, you don't come back. Hmm. And their recidivism rate has dropped to 20%.
Wow. So it worked.
That's a model that we could use.
It worked. How long have we known that everything we've been doing is wrong?
You know, we can look back really easily to the 50s, 60s, 70s. There was a lot wrong with psychiatric hospitals, and a movement of real altruism came forward to shift people out of these institutions that were, by all admissions, somewhat draconian at the time, into the community where they could have a less restrictive environment and receive care in the community. The problem was that the funds needed to be allocated to support severely mentally ill people in the community never materialized. So I think we can look to that moment as the moment where people shift from being within the healthcare system to suddenly sleeping in doorways, sleeping on park benches, begging for food, begging for money, stealing subsistence items, not getting housing, food, and medication, and suddenly they shift from the auspices of healthcare into the auspices of the legal system. Mm-hmm. We criminalize mental illness instead of treating it appropriately.
So if we were to build enough mental health facilities to handle everyone who needs help, and therefore get a large proportion of homeless people off the streets, what would it cost? Is it affordable?
Well, I think it could be more affordable than the way that we're handling it now. The largest psychiatric institution in the country is the Cook County Jail. It holds more mentally ill people than any other facility in the country, and we know corrections are incredibly expensive. I see this in my inpatient work when people come in for emergency after emergency. Often we could pay for an entire year of outpatient treatment and housing for the cost of a single inpatient hospitalization. So our current methods are inefficient and too expensive.
How long have we known that?
for a long time. So I think, but this is actually a moment of great hope for me, because this, in a moment when there's almost zero bipartisan consensus on anything in America, there is bipartisan agreement that we need prison reform. Yeah. Newt Gingrich and Cory Booker shared a stage together talking about the need for prison reform. We recognize on both sides of the aisle that it's ineffective, inefficient, inhumane, and expensive. And that, to me, is a really hopeful sign.
You mentioned that you found good examples in Norway and Sweden of how to do this the right way. Any American states actually embarked on something like this?
Yeah, so there's a program in California that actually has been taking stakeholders, and when I say stakeholders, I mean wardens and correctional officers and legislators over abroad to visit these facilities in Scandinavia and in Germany so that they can then bring back some of these practices to their own facilities. And part of the selling point for these people who work in these facilities is to see how much higher the job satisfaction is for the correctional officers. The role of those officers has really been redefined in Scandinavia, where instead of being purely about security and domination, it's really more like a social worker or a nurse. There's a way in which the officers collaborate with the detainees, they get to know them, and they work together to be future-oriented to make sure the person is building a life that will serve them when they leave. And job satisfaction is up in addition to recidivism rates being down. So there are places in North Dakota, in Los Angeles County, and even in my home state of Rhode Island that are making a real effort to implement some of these changes. And it's slow going because mm-hmm. institutional memory is long and our practices are really entrenched. But I think that little by little, people are starting to understand that what we're doing doesn't work. So what is there to lose by trying something that we know has been demonstrated to do better?
Dr. Christine Montross is the author of Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration. A lot of examples there. And most importantly, as she mentioned, some good news, too, because this is not just your own fantasy vision. It's actually happening in places and working.
That's right. Absolutely.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. There are a lot of people who are worried that the government is going to force them to get vaccinated, and they just are not ready to accept that. But it's not going to be the government. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And Dr. Cohen, what we're seeing, instead of the government requiring you to get a vaccine, is, well, very possibly your employer, especially if you work in the healthcare industry.
Yeah, that's true, Dave. Actually, a lot of healthcare corporations and universities are going to start mandating that all their employees get the COVID vaccine. And what's interesting is it's actually appears to be happening on a regional basis so that employees can't run from one institution to another, one where they have to get it to another where they don't have to get it. What disappoints me more than anything, and we've repeatedly talked about this, is this is not a political issue. It shouldn't be a political issue, but it's become a political issue. You know, there's a lot of concern that relates to the rapidity or the apparent rapidity with which the vaccine was brought out.
Right. And that seems to be the part that disturbed people, that it got out so fast. But to me, that was the big feature of Operation Warp Speed. It was a tremendous financial risk, but they started manufacturing the vaccines before they had final approval. They didn't distribute them until they had approval, but they manufactured them, which saved a lot of time. That's my understanding anyway.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That is exactly what happened, and it was a risk, but it was a worthwhile risk because they understood that if it worked, and they felt pretty confident that it was going to work, that it would save a ton of time and lives would be saved. Now, here's the thing about where there's a lot of misinformation about the vaccine. A lot of people think that the vaccine can actually alter your DNA and that this is a new type of vaccine. Now, here's the thing. The mRNA vaccines, the messenger RNA vaccines, they actually teach our cells, our own cells, to make a protein or even just a piece of a protein that triggers an immune response inside our bodies. Well, guess what a virus does when it enters our body? The virus takes over our cell to make proteins, to replicate itself. And in this case, we're only taking a little piece of this messenger and having it create a little piece of protein enough that it can stimulate an immune response. Well, people say, well, that can still alter your DNA. No, it cannot. The messenger RNA comes nowhere near the DNA. It actually works in a different part of the cell. And I've tried to think of a good analogy, and the best thing I can think of is this. If you and I are talking to each other on a cell phone, we're talking into a device, and it takes our words and it converts them into an electronic signal, and it sends them through a cell tower, and you receive it on your end, and you hear what I say. Now, it's that signal that goes from my phone to your phone that is the same as the role that the messenger RNA plays. It's essentially read-only. So it's not able to alter your phone. It's not able to alter my phone. It's not able to alter your cell. It's not able to alter my cell. So all this misinformation about how the mRNA is changing our genetic code is just not correct. And there needs to be better education in the public so that people understand that the risk is really small. That really the COVID mRNA vaccines, they really give instructions for our cells to make a really harmless piece of what is only part of the virus, the spike protein, and it's our antibody response that develops in response to the produced spike protein, only a part of the virus, not the whole virus, only a part of the virus.
So it sounds like you're saying that biology classes, when they're teaching the mechanics of the cell, should include a little bit of vaccine theory too.
It absolutely should. And, you know, people are worried about the different types of vaccines and worried about actually getting COVID from the vaccine. But if you look at the history of vaccines, we've used all different sorts of vaccines in this country, things we don't even think twice about. So, for example, one of the more common vaccines that are still given to children is what's called an alive attenuated virus. So we actually take the virus and we weaken it. And that's like the measles, the mumps, rubella, the MMR that we get as a child, the varicella, which is for chickenpox, and even the nose spray for the flu. So we are actually giving people the actual virus. When we do the mRNA vaccine, we are not doing that. For polio and hepatitis A, we use an inactivated killed virus. So we actually take the actual polio virus, the actual hepatitis A virus, and we kill it, so to speak, but we still give it to the patient. If we think about, you know, viruses that create toxins like diphtheria or tetanus, we actually take the actual toxin that's produced and we inactivate the toxin and then we give it to a patient so that they develop an antibody to it. So we've actually used far more harmful things over the history of time, and then we're still using them to create vaccinations. And yet this, what really is a very, very safe platform technology, just using a little piece of mRNA that's wrapped in a lipid nanoparticle to induce a antibody response to just the spike protein, just a little piece of the virus, has created all this uproar, and it's not warranted.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
A Chicago man has been nicknamed the Great Lake Jumper for his unique way of helping local musicians and venues affected by the pandemic. CBS's Adriana Diaz has your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
For months, Dan O'Connor has shocked his senses, clearing his mind by jumping into Lake Michigan.
What do people call you now?
The Great Lake Jumper.
He's done it every day for a year since last June. The 53-year-old father of three was at first looking for relief from a hangover and the news cycle.
It was a dark time. It was the pandemic. The protests were starting to happen. The election and politics. I could come down here and cleanse the palate and start anew.
And he kept coming back for this pandemic therapy.
The positive feedback people are reaching out saying, this brightens my day, seeing, you know, you jump in the lake.
How do you feel when somebody says, this brightens my day?
You know, it brightened my day. And I think we all needed that during the pandemic. We all needed to find some light.
O'Connor kept at it through Chicago's notorious winter.
Oh, my God.
Breaking the ice however he could.
People jump in this lake and they don't survive.
I think it crossed my mind every time I came down here. I had to be 100% present.
What does your mom say to you?
You're not jumping in that lake, are you?
On his wife Margaret's advice, the music buff is using his jumping to raise awareness for Chicago musicians and venues struggling in the pandemic.
I think it's really special. Why am I crying all of a sudden? It is. It's really unique. I mean, from the people who he helped get through it, you know, remotely.
Get through the pandemic?
Yeah, yeah.
When we visited, this group had a special song for O'Connor.
But he jumps every day.
To me, I think that so much joy came from one person's relatively small act.
I don't know if it's small. I think it's a big commitment. Something that's clearly crazy brings people together.
Just like it did for his one-year jump.
So what has this done for your mental health?
I think it's definitely improved my, outlook. You can do something really small, and it can turn into something big.
A positive spin there on go jump in a lake, but wear your life jacket, please.
Yes, good idea. From the G and Ursula Show, which is weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G Scott.
Morning, brother.
Let me play you this clip from the governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey.
Folks supposed to have common sense. But it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks. It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down.
Blame the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks. And you're seeing more concern be expressed on social media of, I guess you could call it, vaccinism. We have a new group of second-class citizens. Do you worry about this?
Yes. I worry about the messaging, right? I worry, for an example, what the governor of Alabama just said, she can get away with that. Could you imagine what would happen if you or I started off our shows with exactly what she said?
Yes.
If we said what she said, people would go crazy. And so here's the problem. I believe that there are certain people around the country that have platforms that are terrible with their messaging. So much so that they put money over human decency. And so what is starting to happen in this country is people are really bad with their delivery. And what the governor said, that. I choose not to do it that way. I choose to say, hey, I don't want anybody to get sick. I don't want anyone to pass away. And yes, we are going backwards with this pandemic. And yes, cases, I mean, this is right there. COVID cases are going up across the country. The states of Florida, some of these places are really bad. Even with that being said, the only thing that's probably going to have to do, and people aren't going to like this, is what you're starting to see. We are probably going to have to go back to wearing masks again. I was in a restaurant yesterday, Brother Dave, and I took a picture of this sign, and I just kept thinking about this sign. I know my significant other was just like, why are you taking pictures of signs? But I had to take a picture of it. And the sign says, correct me if you have seen this sign before, let me know. By the way, I think this sign is the most passive-aggressive sign in the entire world. Here it goes. Thank you for wearing a mask if you are not fully vaccinated. Wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait. Let me read that again. Thank you for wearing a mask if you are not fully vaccinated. So I guess my question that I had to ask myself, I said, self, the people that choose not to be vaccinated, whether it's for religious reasons, whatever the reasons are, you mean to tell me that the honor system is so much so that they're saying, I'm going to wear a mask?
Well, here's my reaction to that is I've seen signs like that, and I'm vaccinated, right? But now I'm worried if I were to wear a mask to be extra cautious, I'm signaling that I'm one of the abnormal people who's not vaccinated.
You know See? What I'm saying? You can't win for losing.
That's it.
No. I don't. So, again, I think that the leadership way, the best way, the way to not point at others and not signal call and try to just, I don't know, try to be a better human being is to not do with right now the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are going to be doing. They're going to be doing yellow and wristbands, yellow and red wristbands.
Yo, really?
Yeah. The vaccinated.
Well, Chris, you were suggesting that if somebody like Nick Saban spoke out, that would make a difference. I mean, are there other public people who...
In Alabama, certainly.
Yeah.
And he's been pushing it a little bit. I mean, he's like God in this down there. If he would... I mean, if people like that the folks down there follow so intently. I mean, if Coach O at LSU would say the same thing, I think people might follow their lead.
I think Sully is absolutely right in what he's saying. I'll give you an example here locally. For a year and a half, the Gian Ursula show had a virologist on that studies this stuff, studies infectious diseases. We had her on once a week, every week, to talk about COVID and then later on eventually talking about vaccinations. Dave, I haven't seen one email come to us, and I'm not saying that it's not possible, that said, hey, Dr. Rasmussen, the virologist who studies this stuff, is the reason why I decided to go get the vaccine.
Yeah,
but I can probably count over 20 messages in which people wrote in and said, Sully is the reason why I'm going to get the vaccine.
Look at that.
So to Sully's point and what he's saying, yes, for sure the Nick Sabans of Alabama would help out because even though he hasn't studied it, he's considered, you know, he's almost like a god in Alabama because they love football so much. And the same thing I'll say for... Now, imagine if there are leaders who choose to say that COVID's going to go away by Easter or that it's nothing more than the flu.
Who would say that?
I don't know who would say that. What kind of impact would that have on our country? And so if I can sit here and tell you that people are emailing our show telling us Sully is the reason why they decided to get the vaccine. Now, what is the opposite of when you have people with platforms or people in politics that choose to say things like, this is no big deal? And what kind of impact can that have on our country?
I get it. G and Ursula, 9 o'clock, Cairo Radio. Thanks, G. Well, it's not Chicago-level violence, but this is not Chicago. This is Seattle, and we had 9 people shot, 4 of them killed in less than 24 hours in what appear to be mostly unrelated incidents over the weekend. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott says it's the latest in the uptick in shootings that this region has been seeing.
We got the numbers last week from King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg.
The first 6 months of this year, 196 people were shot in King County. That's a 60% increase over the 4-year average. That's more than one person a day who was shot in King County. Of the 196 people who were shot, 42 of them died. That's a 50% increase in fatalities. 154 people were shot. They didn't die. That's a 65% increase.
But it's about more than the numbers. Early Sunday morning, within about 3 hours, gunshots rang out in every direction with shootings in Belltown, Capitol Hill, the Chinatown International District, and Pioneer Square, right across from Amari Salisbury and Converge Media's studio. Amari, I know you and none of your coworkers were there when this shooting happened, but last night as you were walking to work, you came across a vigil for one of the 2 people killed in that shooting.
I thought that it was important to be able to at least take a picture to share with the city that it's like, man, you know, there's a family that's out here tonight that's grieving the loss of their loved one. And so I took that photo and kind of tweeted it out. And the mom, she was inconsolable. You know, I mean, you could just hear her just screaming and crying. And one of the family members was like, man, you need to talk to mom.
And this was during what was supposed to be a celebration. Here's some of your conversation with mom.
My baby died trying to kick it for his daddy's birthday. He threw a party for his dad, and he died at his dad's birthday party.
This was a party for his deceased father.
He got everybody together, had a barbecue, and then everybody came here to kind of celebrate afterwards. He never made it in this club. He was just outside. Some girls started fighting. He tried to break it up and got killed. Being a
he tried to stop somebody else from fighting, and he got killed.
Good God. They got shot at his back walking away. He didn't deserve that, man. He was a good man.
Why was it important for you to share this?
For people in our city to see, you know, what's happening here and the impact. And, you know, a lot of times here in the Emerald City, if it's not in your district or not on your block, then, or if it's not aligned with your politics, then a lot of times we just don't care. And I think that, you know, for us to really disrupt gun violence and violence as a whole in our city, that we all have to get on the same team, and that we have to put the health, the wellness, and the humanity of our city above politics.
And Amari, I know you live in the Central District and work in Pioneer Square, so you're no stranger to these shootings. And it's been about a year since you started joining us on Cairo to highlight the gun violence issue in your community. What do you think needs to happen?
We need buy-in from everybody. Everybody, we need to care. You see what I'm saying? Like, as a city, if in our minds, acceptable number for us, then man, something's wrong with us. This, you know, this isn't okay. But the only way that we're really going to make a dent, everybody in our city to realize and to get on board and get behind the fact that what's going on right now is it's young people are dropping in this city. They're being murdered. This is a public health crisis that's impacting not just the murder victim and their family.
And what do you mean by that?
Imagine on Saturday night, hundreds of people were out there. Hundreds of people. So now these people are traumatized. You know, they're impacted. You know, this is we have to. I think if people in this city realize the ripple effects of some of the things that are occurring, maybe they look at things differently. But man, we know that the city of Seattle has a big heart when it wants to. And it has a lot of humanity when it wants to. But, man, around this issue, we can't be a la carte. We can't say, oh, we'll have humanity for this and no humanity for that. We have to really have a willingness to care.
Well, Mari Salisbury and Hannah, we're getting a report that there's been another shooting at 8th and Yesler today.
Yep, I am just seeing that. And so that would be the sixth shooting in really at just over 24 hours. And so far, I know the initial four shootings that we had on early Sunday morning, including that one in Pioneer Square, was not what we were hearing from SPD was that those were not related, nothing retaliatory there. I know Amari had told me that when he was talking to that family at the vigil last night about 10 or 11, while he was standing there, he saw them get the news that there had been another shooting, possibly that one that was in Lake City. So unclear if these last two were or any kind of retaliation or anything like that for some of these others.
Right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.